I would like to play the fool in Lear. It's a most sympathetic, beautiful comic part. In the last analysis, when you walk on the stage, there's nothing anybody can do, which is a strange, fascinating feeling and something that I love and hate at the same time. I am fundamentally insecure. There is no question of this. I think most artists are. Ladies and gentlemen, Hancock's Anthology. I don't know if you know what you like, but I know what I like in humour, people and music. And that's what this programme is all about. This is a record of Johnny Hodges playing with Duke Ellington. That's always the trouble with this mob. They will not finish off a tune. Not that it matters to you, because by mid-afternoon today, all you lot will be sitting in an armchair, bloated with too much food, wearing a ridiculous hat and buying a couple of days' oblivion before January the 1st and the tax. Inevitably, someone will suggest party games. Well, you can keep Postman's Knock, charades and sardines, but Stephen Leacock, one of my favourite writers, has a suggestion. Here's one of them called Indoor Football or Football Without a Ball. In this game, any number of players from 15 to 30 seat themselves in a heap on any one player, usually the player next to the dealer. They then challenge him to get up, while one player stands with a stopwatch in his hand and counts 40 seconds. Should the first player fail to rise before 40 seconds, I count you, the player with the watch declares him suffocated. This is called a down and counts one. The player who was the down is then leant against the wall. His wind is supposed to be squeezed out. The player called the referee then blows a whistle, and the player selects another player and scores a down off him. While the player is supposed to be down, all the rest must remain seated as before and not rise from him until the referee, by counting 40 and blowing his whistle, announces that in his opinion the other player is trifled. He is then leant against the wall beside the first player. When the whistle again blows, the player nearest the referee strikes him behind the right ear. This is a touch and counts two. It is impossible, of course, to give all the rules in detail. I might add, however, that while it counts two to strike the referee, to kick him counts three, to break his arm or leg counts four, and to kill him outright is called Grand Slam and counts one game. Here's Count Basie, one of my great favourites, saying, "Come fly with me." Thank you. man's nature twines the eternal passion of song, it says on the cover of this one. Well, I don't know about that, but there's a couple of lines in this lyrics that I particularly like. Here's Carl McKay singing Midnight Sun. Under a grand piano in Wood Green, had seven take me thrown at me by the gallery when I was playing Bristol, and people always come up to you and say, you don't know how to make your money easy in this business, don't you? But there are times when everything seems to be going fine, you've got the audience beating out of the palm of your hand, they're falling apart, and suddenly overconfidence sets in. In the middle of a big laugh, beating round the hall, you suddenly spot the one man who is sitting there wearing an expression of distaste bordering on loathing, and going, well, often there's nothing you can do about that. Perhaps one should have been a conjurer. Now, ladies and gentlemen, said the conjurer, having shown you that the cloth is absolutely empty, I will proceed to take from it a bowl of goldfish. Presto. All around the hall, people were saying, oh, how wonderful, how did he do it? But the quick man on the front seat said in a big whisper to the people near him, he had it up his sleeve. Then the people nodded brightly at the quick man and said, oh, of course. And everybody whispered round the hall. He had it up his sleeve. My next trick, said the conjurer, is the famous Hindustani ring. You will notice the rings are apparently separate. At a blow, they all join. Clang, clang, clang. Presto. There was a general buzz of stupefaction till the quick man was heard to whisper, he must have another lot up his sleeve. Again, everybody nodded and whispered. The rings were up his sleeve. The brow of the conjurer was cloudy with a gathering frown. I will now, he continued, show you a most amusing trick by which I am enabled to take any number of eggs from a hat. Will some gentleman kindly lend me his hat? Ah, thank you, sir. Presto! He extracted 17 eggs, and for 35 seconds the audience began to think he was wonderful. Then the quick man whispered along the front bench, he has a hen up his sleeve. And all the people whispered it on. He has a lot of hens up his sleeve. The egg trick was ruined. It went on like that also. It transpired from the whispers of the quick man that the conjurer must have concealed up his sleeve, in addition to the rings, hens and fish, several packs of cards, a loaf of bread, a doll's cradle, a live guinea pig, a 50-cent piece and a rocking chair. The reputation of the conjurer was rapidly sinking below zero. At the close of the evening, he rallied for a final effort. Ladies and gentlemen, he said, I will present to you, in conclusion, the famous Japanese trick, recently invented by the natives of Tipperary. Will you, sir, he continued, turning towards the quick man, will you kindly hand me your gold watch? It was past him. Have I your permission to put it into this mortar and pound it to pieces, he asked savagely. The quick man nodded and smiled. The conjurer threw the watch into the mortar and grasped the sledgehammer from the table. There was a sound of violent smashing. He slipped it up his sleeve, whispered the quick man. Now, sir, continued the conjurer, will you allow me to take your handkerchief and punch holes in it? Thank you, sir. You see, ladies and gentlemen, there is no deception. The holes are visible to the eye. The face of the quick man beamed. This time the real mystery of the thing fascinated him. And now, sir, will you kindly pass me your silk hat and allow me to dance on it? Thank you. Conjurer made a few rapid passes with his feet and exhibited the hat, crushed beyond recognition. And would you now, sir, take off your celluloid collar and permit me to burn it in the candle? Thank you, sir. And will you allow me to smash your spectacles for you with my hammer? Thank you. By this time, the features of the quick man were assuming a puzzled expression. This thing beats me, he whispered. I don't see through it a bit. There was a great hush upon the audience. Then the conjurer drew himself up to his full height, and with a withering look at the quick man, he concluded, ladies and gentlemen, you will observe that I have, with this gentleman's permission, broken his watch, burnt his collar, smashed his spectacles, and danced on his hat. If he will give me the further permission to paint green stripes on his overcoat, or to tie his braces in a knot, I shall be delighted to entertain you. If not, the performance is at an end. And that was Stephen Leacock again with The Conjurer's Revenge. Once upon a time, a very long time ago now, about last Friday, Willie the Pooh lived in a forest all by himself, under the name Saunders. What does the name mean? Asked Christopher Robin. It means he had the name over the door in gold letters and lived under it. However, Caterina Valente.
Unable to see, I fell in love with love.
That was Caterina Valente, falling in love with love, accompanied by Max Jaffa and the trio. Now, there are three things you must never say about anybody. One, they have no sense of humour. Two, that they snore. And thirdly, that they can't drive. I'll come to the driving bit in a minute, but I should like to go on record as a man to whom flying is a kiss of death. Now, I was sitting next to this chap reading the highly intellectual magazines of the girls in bikinis on the covers, who I happen to recognise as Sterling Moss, when I mentioned that I was an extremely bad driver, and now I say it myself. He's here with me now, and he's... What did you say?
I said, well, you were only the second man who had admitted this.
I see. Who was the other?
The other was Gilbert Harding, and it surprised me because Gilbert Harding and yourself, in my opinion, had got to a position in life that mattered, and yet at the same time they were prepared to admit here was a thing that they could not do that every man normally does do.
Certainly. It's the same when somebody asks you to go on a stage, really. What would you say was your best race?
I think 1961 at Monte Carlo.
Yes.
And the reason for that is not that I drove necessarily any better or faster than normally, but I think that I kept up the pressure of going flat out for much longer time. In other words, 90 of the 100 laps, that's 90% of the race, I was just about at my maximum.
Yes, you were. Right, this question of speed of reaction. What, did you have 10 tenths?
No, 10 tenths is a phrase given to a man who's flat out. When you come to reaction time, there's an awful lot spoken about it, and I think about 3 tenths is pretty good. 2,700ths is even better. But I think that one has to be careful about these, because I have had a reaction. This sounds fantastic. Maybe it was fantastically bad. I don't know. Mm. But I remember once I was driving along, and I suddenly frightened myself because I put the brake on. I didn't know why. I was throwing forward.
Mm.
Then I realized that a dog or a kid was starting to run out. And this worried me, because, after all, it meant that my eye had transmitted a message to my foot, had stopped the car or started to, before I told it to. Well, this is worrying, you know. It doesn't mean I was that fast. It just means that I surfaced my brain, if you like.
True, because I remember, actually, when I took my driving test, which was a bit of a laugh, really. However, I got through for some extraordinary reason after asking what the gearbox was for. The only thing I ever did well, he said, at some moment I'm going to ask you to stop. And his head practically disappeared through the windscreen, because he just said, I have a quick reaction, probably like you, in the same way, you know, but that was about all I did well. Still, I got through.
That
was my still patches up. Tell me about this thing when we were talking about the 4-minute mile.
Well,
can you explain this to me, that when Bannister broken the 4 minutes, what do you think psychologically happens to all the other people who broke it afterwards? And I think there were quite a lot in a very short time.
Oh, an awful lot. And it's now, 53 minutes, 54 or so.
Mm.
I think that's what made Bannister the greatest miler in my lifetime. Not because he was the fastest, but because he was the first to break the barrier.
Sure.
Now, in motor racing, we have a barrier for every circuit, which is the lap record.
Yes.
There is no speed barrier as such. But once a man has achieved something, the other drivers suddenly wake up and say, well, we can go around this circuit at 102 miles an hour, or whatever the lap time may be. It's been done. Good Lord, we've got to do it. And then they will do it. And by then, if a man is good enough, he will have done 103. And so you're continually trying to improve.
Sure.
And I think this must go on through everything. I don't think that necessarily milers are better fed or better trained than they were, and I don't think drivers necessarily are. I think that it is that people overcome their mental barrier. And I think in racing, as in many things, it is mental. There's physical fatigue and mental fatigue.
Yeah.
Now, it is easy to prove that it's physically tiring.
May I interrupt? Yes. How much does the actual mental fatigue affect the physical fatigue?
I don't know that I think it does a bit. I think people are inclined to overplay this and say, well, you're tired because of the mental. I think that it's something quite apart from, but obviously knitted together a bit.
Mm.
But when you go into a race, you have the tremendous heat of the car, in the car.
Yes.
You have the physical fatigue, not the work that you're doing, because turning a steering wheel isn't heavy. It is being ready to do the thing you need to take. No, even after 24 hours, 25 days, if you like. But it is being ready to do the thing instantaneously, like that. This is, of course, tiring.
Yes.
If you hold your hand absolutely taut, you won't be able to hold it taut for a minute. I don't care who you are. I shouldn't think you would. But if you just leave it out there, you can leave it loosely, shall we say, for a long time. Well, I think that in racing, you are more or less taut, but you mustn't be quite taut. Now, this is where the mental side comes in. And I believe that a driver who's going around any circuit is mentally terribly taut. I don't think you can help it.
No doubt about it.
The point is racing. I would like to say this now. Racing does not require courage. It requires a particular type of courage. A courage to the onlooker, yes. But if any driver, when he gets into a car, has to seal up his courage, shall we say, for 2 or 3 hours, I don't think a man could do it. If a man has to overcome his fear to drive a car, then he's crazy to do it. Maybe you get twinges of it.
Well, what is courage with the domination of fear?
Courage is very near stupidity, Tony, let's face it.
Sure.
Neither you or I are qualified to say which is which.
No, never mind. Thank you for coming. Incidentally, I have bought a game this Christmas.
What's that one?
It's a car driving game with 4 little switches, 4 cars and 4 tracks.
Well, an indoor thing?
I find indoors.
Yeah, I know.
Would
you
like to beat you with this?
If it's like the American one, you will eat me up because a boy of 14 just annihilated me not long ago.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
All right.
Hang on. I'll give it a couple of turns with the old handle for you.
Hey, he really worships that car.
It's his life, you know. But it's no use having a car if you haven't got a touch of romance. It's a rare commodity, I grant you, but everyone needs it. To each his own, of course. I know a plumber who goes into raptures over a good white joint. And for some people, it's Michelangelo. For James Thurber's man, it was a fabulous beast. Thurber wrote it. I'll tell it. Once upon a sunny morning, a man who sat in a breakfast nook looked up from his scrambled eggs to see a white unicorn with a golden horn quietly cropping the roses in the garden. The man went up to the bedroom where his wife was still asleep and woke her. There's a unicorn in the garden, he said, eating roses. She opened one unfriendly eye and looked at him. The unicorn is a mythical beast, she said, and turned her back on him. The man walked slowly downstairs and out into the garden. The unicorn was still there. He was now browsing among the tulips. Here, unicorn, said the man, and he pulled up a lily and gave it to him. The unicorn ate it gravely. With a high heart, because there was a unicorn in his garden, the man went upstairs and roused his wife again. The unicorn, he said, ate a lily. His wife sat up in bed and looked at him coldly. You are a booby, she said, and I am going to have you put in the booby hatch. The man, who had never liked the words booby and booby hatch, who liked them even less on a shining morning when there was a unicorn in his garden, thought for a moment. We'll see about that, he said. He walked over to the door. He has a golden horn in the middle of his forehead, he told her. Then he went back to the garden to watch the unicorn. The unicorn had gone away. The man sat down among the roses and went to sleep. As soon as the husband had got out of the house, the wife got up and dressed as fast as she could. She was very excited and with a gloat in her eye. She telephoned the police and she telephoned the psychiatrist. She told them to hurry to her house and bring a straitjacket. When the police and psychiatrist arrived, they sat down in chairs and looked at her with great interest. My husband, she said, saw a unicorn this morning. The police looked at the psychiatrist. The psychiatrist looked at the police. He told me it ate a lily, she said. The psychiatrist looked at the police, and the police looked at the psychiatrist. He told me it had a golden horn in the middle of its forehead, she said. At a solemn signal from the psychiatrist, the police leapt from their chairs and seized the wife. They had a hard time subduing her, for she put up a terrific struggle, but they finally did subdue her. Just as they got into the straitjacket, the husband came back into the house. Did you tell your wife you saw a unicorn, asked the police. Of course not, said the husband. The unicorn is a mythical beast. That's all I wanted to know, said the psychiatrist. Take it away. I'm sorry, sir, but your wife is as crazy as a jaybird. So they took it away, cursing and screaming, and shut her up in an institution. The husband lived happily ever after. I don't know if any of you saw a French film called Le Lit, The Bed. It was about 4 men talking about their dreams concerning this essential article of furniture. In one episode, incongruous though it may seem, there was a chap tearing down the road in one of those large French lorries, singing this song. Thank you.
se rencontrera quelque part, n'importe où, guidé par le hasard. Nous nous regarderons et nous nous sourirons. Et la main dans la main, par les rues nous irons. Le temps passe si vite, le soir cachera bien nos cœurs et de voleurs qui gardent leur bonheur. Puis nous arriverons sur une place grise où les pavés seront doux à nos âmes grises. Il y aura un bal très pauvre et très banal, sous un ciel plein de brume et de mélancolie. Un aveugle jouera d'orgue de barbarie. C'est-elle pour nous sera le plus beau, le plus joli. Puis je t'inviterai, ta taille je prendrai, nous danserons tranquille loin des gens de la ville. Nous danserons l'amour, les yeux au fond des yeux, vers une fin du monde, vers une nuit profonde. Un jour, tu verras, on se rencontrera, quelque part, n'importe où, guidé par le hasard. Nous nous regarderons et nous nous sourirons, et la main dans la main, par les rues, nous
Duffy and Sweeney, who were usually billed either as Russian entertainers extraordinary or as two minds without a single thought. Their act was marked by a certain labor-saving nonchalance and by a kind of mild dementia that puzzled the average playgoer, but was nicely calculated to reduce some such sympathetic soul as our own Mr. Benchley, let us say, to tears of helpless laughter. Clad in fur coats, it was their practice to drift vaguely onto the stage, collapse slowly by some kind of wilting process until they were lying end to end in the footlight trough, and then hold a colloquy which would last until their act was finished. It was often an anxious problem in management to get them both to the theatre on time. Once in Canada, when their position on the bill was preceded by a mind-reading act, and Mr. Duffy was reported missing as their time approached, Mr. Sweeney had the presence of mind to slip into the audience and scribble enough questions to keep the mind-reader working over time. And finally, when this device had spent itself, to send an usher up with a slip of paper which put the crucial question, where is Mr. Duffy? Mr. Duffy was, as it turned out, dozing at that moment in a limousine parked near the stage door. It had tempted him on his way to work. Another time in Chicago, Mr. Sweeney had to warn the stage manager that Mr. Duffy was even then lingering in the Turkish bath and would therefore inevitably be late. He was roughly told to get the coverage on the telephone at once. The stage manager himself roared into the mouthpiece, what is eating you, Mr. Duffy? You ought to be here and made up this minute. Well, you're on now. Are we, Mr. Duffy replied. And after a pause, he asked anxiously, how are we going? But the misdemeanor which permanently alienated the affections of their agents came that afternoon in Memphis. It seems that the two minds without a single thought were not tuned to the audience that day, which was more than merely unresponsive. Its silence had a kind of malignance. The good people of Memphis appeared actually to resent the antics of these zanies. It was as if they all had come to the theatre to think over their private worries and do not wish to be disturbed. After 10 minutes of this congealing experience, Mr. Duffy rose, brushed the dust from his knees, stepped forward with an ingratiating informality. Shyly, he said, he just wished to thank Memphis for one of the most heartwarming receptions within his memory as a poor strolling player. And now, he added, his manner changing subtly to the cheerful bustle of a master's ceremonies. If you'll all just remain seated, my partner, Mr. Sweeney, will pass down the aisle with a baseball bat and beat the bejesus out of you.
I don't know whether she ever played Memphis, but one of the most exciting theatrical experiences I've ever had was at the Dominion in Tottenham Court Road when I saw Judy Garland. She came on, she'd torn her dress, looked very unhappy about this, any woman would. I stood there, quite dumpy, looking slightly embarrassed. But being a professional, she began to work on this audience without, apparently at first, a great deal of enthusiasm. But suddenly, she finished one number, had a good look at them, and with the natural and acceptable arrogance of a great artist, decided she was not going to stand there and make a fool of herself. And from then on, she absolutely had them where she wanted them. And the number she really broke them apart with was The Man That Got Away. Frank Sinatra recorded this once, and I have a great admiration for him, but this is essentially a woman's song, and essentially a Judy Garland song.
The night is bitter, the stars have lost their glitter, the winds grow colder, suddenly older, and all because of the man that got away.
Intend to be the next honours list. Don't drink if you drive. Don't drive if you drink. Be nice to each other. And if I don't get an OB after all this, I shall turn the whole thing in. Good luck. Anne Cox Anthology was produced by Richard Dingley.